Well, greetings again. My name is Paul Weber, and I am delighted to welcome you to today's teleclass, The Human and Environmental Toxicity of Microbicidal Chemicals. Thank you all for making the time to spend with us today. If you have joined even a few teleclasses in the past, you've undoubtedly heard me speak of Dr. Syed Sattar, the co-founder of Teleclass Education. When Dr. Sattar is asked about the remarkable successes that his organization has had, he always points to Susan Springthorpe as one of the primary reasons. Susan is the Associate Director of the Center for Research on Environmental Microbiology at the University of Ottawa Faculty of Medicine, and she has worked as a colleague with Dr. Sattar for some 30 years. In that time, she has published scientific articles in several very notable journals. She has been a featured speaker at several regional, national, and international conferences. And on the topic of microbicides, Susan Springthorpe is a leading authority worldwide. It is a real honor to have her with us for this teleclass lecture today. But before Susan begins, I would like to acknowledge the support of Virox Technologies. Virox is one of the organizations that provides financial support to the Teleclass Education Program. I'd like to thank those nice folk for their support of this teleclass in particular and for the way that they advance infection control education as a whole. Thank you very much. So to present the teleclass, The Human and Environmental Toxicity of Microbicidal Chemicals from the University of Ottawa, it is a real pleasure to present Susan Springthorpe. Susan.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. I'd like to welcome everybody and say good afternoon, and perhaps I could have the first slide. You will see at this slide a little poem, which is quite cute, and this short poem may sum up the limit of knowledge about germs that exists amongst most of the general public at large. Of course, however, you and I both know that man has evolved in a world full of microorganisms, many of which are yet unrecognized and unnamed, and only a very small fraction of these are pathogens for humans. The majority are actually very helpful to us. And even if you consider all the known pathogens of vertebrate species, then this is still a very small number of microorganisms compared to the large range that is actually out there in the environment. However, the ability of an unseen microbe to rapidly incapacitate or even, in cases, kill a human instills a very instinctive fear of germs that is sort of fed insatiably by the media and by advertising from manufacturers of microbicides. It's only within the last 15 or 20 years that there's really been a pressure to sort of sanitize everything with chemicals. And this has become so prominent in our society these days in view of the marketing of many domestic products. And I think we have to ask in general whether this is a good thing. And I hope to convince you that it probably is not. But obviously everybody will make up their own minds in this regard. Of course, we've only known about microbes really for a very short time during our history, and since their discovery, we've moved from being a species which is very active and earns its living largely off the land to one where many individuals are now largely urbanized and live a very sedentary indoor existence. And during this transition, it's almost certain that our exposure has also radically altered, perhaps in the numbers of microorganisms we're exposed to, but certainly in the types, because those that you find and which are supported in indoor environments are quite different to many of those that might encounter, say, in an agricultural setting. Now, what you all know the potential benefits that one can achieve by the use of microbicidal chemicals. I don't need to tell you about those. The intent today is to discuss perhaps the downsides of disinfectant use, the toxicity for humans and the environment. To understand these issues, it's also important to focus on the interactions that occur among humans, or other species for that matter, microbial pathogens and chemicals in the environment. So while these interactions are very common to a wide range of chemicals, and especially so within a healthcare institution where the widespread use of microbicides makes them an extremely important factor. Finally, it is clear that the widespread use of microbicidal chemicals for infection control will lead to alterations in the microbial flora found in these chemically exposed niches within perhaps a hospital. And this could be everything from the sink to the toilet or to anywhere really you find in a hospital. So I will try and address these issues sort of in turn, from the toxicity itself, the direct interactions, and perhaps the byproducts that are formed between microbicides and the other organic material that they interact with, and why the exposure of bacteria in these environments to sublethal levels of biocides is so important. So this slide really sort of sets the stage for those of you who do not routinely work either with chemicals or with microorganisms. The toxicity of many chemicals is very well recognized, and their effects can be very variable both among species and among individuals within a species, and that of course includes humans. There are, however, generally good analytical tools to measure concentrations of chemicals and to monitor them in the case of most real identified hazards. However, with microbes, the picture is potentially quite different. Although pathogens themselves have very variable effects on humans, from both an apparent infection to severe debilitation or even death, microorganisms are inherently much more difficult to deal with. If you detect them, they are there. But there's no really good analytical tools, and the methods are not perfect. So they could still be there, even if they're not detected. And this, of course, applies widely in hospitals where even proper hygiene practices cannot hope to get every single microorganism that is out there. The other thing that we have to remember, of course, with infectious microorganisms is that they can replicate, and they do so very well. So I think that that's a big difference with the chemicals. The chemicals themselves can't replicate, except perhaps if you think about things like viruses, which I regard as microorganisms and not chemicals. Perhaps the only saving grace of microbial pathogens is that generally the risk of illness declines with exposure to them, and this is especially so in healthy, immunocompetent people. Not surprisingly, however, we can think that the many or innumerable interactions between chemicals and microbes, since we're surrounded by both, not only do we interact with each of them, but they interact with each other, and that in fact is part of the interest that I have in this topic, and that will become clear, I hope. So although humans can be exposed to both types of agents simultaneously or sequentially, the tragic thing is that our regulatory arena does not deal with exposure to combined risks. In some ways, this is very difficult, and I understand why at the present time they cannot, but it is in fact these combined risks to which we are exposed. Each chemical currently and each pathogen is considered to be present independently. So all the risk analysis that is done on an independent entity. And there's no way currently of assessing all these combined risks. And of course, there are many exposures that may happen infrequently. But in the case of nosocomial pathogens and biocidal chemicals in healthcare, because they are destined to contact each other, then one can imagine these exposures are very, very frequent. So for this talk, we want to focus mostly on the chemicals that are designed to deliberately interact with microbes. If we consider all the pesticides that are out there are more than 20,000 products and lots of active ingredients. Specifically for microbial control, the numbers are less, about 8,000 and about 300 active ingredients. But of course, in the hospital environment, you deal with relatively few, and about 14 actives appear in more than 90% of the available products. And so this is really the focus of interest, primarily. Many chemicals used as preservatives to prolong shelf life of foods, however, have really unknown effects. They're designed primarily to be used in foods, medicines, treated articles, And here they're not designed to kill. They're designed simply to stop the microorganisms growing. So they are exposed at sublethal concentrations. So beyond this, I'm sure you're already familiar with the widespread use of antibiotics in medicine and perhaps in animal husbandry, but you may also be unaware of the fact that they're used for things like spraying fruit trees. So in this context, we should discuss a little bit about the characteristics of microbicides. Man's early antimicrobial use almost certainly derived from native plants, and there are many different natural plant products that have antimicrobial properties. And in part, the plants produce these chemicals to thwart their own pathogens. But such natural products tend to remain localized. They normally are biodegradable by the large range of microbes that are out there in the environment, and they don't build up to the same extent as some of our anthropogenic chemicals. However, since we've been able to grow bacteria and other pathogens in the laboratory, it's been possible to demonstrate very clearly which chemicals have dramatic antimicrobial activity. And particularly simple chemicals that can be readily manufactured and disseminated in large quantities have become the norm for our use. So this has given rise to a very large multi-billion dollar antimicrobial industry, which apart from healthcare serves many different users in the agricultural and industrial sectors. And as we said earlier, for prevention control, it relies on relatively few classes of germicides. So of the many different classes of antimicrobials, those labeled as microbicides, germicides, and disinfectants, which are in many ways almost synonymous words, are intended to kill. And so by their nature, they're very highly toxic. This is the reason that you use them. And because these chemicals are highly reactive, they're simple chemicals, they're highly reactive with many different chemical entities, then when they contact a target cell, they undergo many different reactions. And this contrasts quite markedly with sort of drugs and antibiotics, which are much more specific in their actions. And so due to this broad reactivity, it's rather difficult to pin down the exact mode of action of most microbicides. Although, as you may know, in many cases, the membrane of the microorganism is one of the principal targets. So thus, in addition to having evolved in a world of microbes, those of us alive today certainly live in a chemical world. During the Industrial Revolution, many occupations were heavily exposed to one or more industrial chemicals that compromised individual health. But such exposures are now relatively well controlled by regulation. But the total numbers of chemicals that we're now exposed to is greatly increased, even if for the most part the exposure levels are lower than would give you overt symptoms of toxicity. But you, in fact, are exposed to multiple chemicals, so the effects are truly rather unknown. So modern lifestyles have driven us to this long shelf life foods, consumer goods, personal care products, and all of these now contain some antimicrobials, microbicides in some cases. And the consequent human exposures, we're really unaware of most of these that we contact on a rather regular basis. So this perceived need to prevent microbial contact at all costs and the natural decay of many things that occurs by microorganisms has sort of entered into every sphere of our modern lives. And I believe it can also compromise our ability to prevent infection when it really counts. So hospitals now rely on microbicides quite heavily, and what we need to remember is that compared to our contact with many other chemicals, these are used in rather high concentrations. And exposure to these chemicals also presents certain risks. There's certainly the direct exposure during use, and I think most of you will be very familiar with this and the need to take precautions. There are materials compatibility issues, which I'm not going to discuss today, but they're certainly important also because if you get increased corrosion, for example, you can get increased microbial colonization. The additional toxicity of byproducts that are formed during microbicide use is extremely important. And in fact, in drinking water, this has become a regulated issue. The other thing that I think is really important is the changes in microbial populations that following disinfectant use. Because what you have to remember is that when you're applying a microbicide, if you don't kill all the organisms, you're going to kill the easiest to kill ones first. And the survivors are usually the toughest. And this means that they are going to hang around, they are going to be able to survive their exposure, and they're going to change as a result of that into even tougher organisms, potentially. And we're aware of some of these in relation to antibiotic exposure. So the interaction of microbicides at sublethal pathogens is a really important issue, and it increases in resistance. So I think the main point to emphasize in this slide is that the concentrations of the chemicals are high. And so the toxic action may be expected even after disposal of the chemicals. Certainly, large quantities are disposed from healthcare and industry, and even now domestic use. And it's not entirely clear how many of these are actually ending up in our, for example, in our drinking water. And that is something that we will obviously come to look at more in the near future. You can certainly see some chemicals and some personal care products in drinking water. Antibiotics and triclosan, for example, have already been identified. And of course, there are the microbicides that are used in water and sewage treatment. But many of the ones that you use in hospitals and perhaps are used in domestic settings may also end up there. But there's not yet a lot of information on that. So just mentioning briefly the personal exposure, mainly through skin and by inhalation. There are certainly other cases that would be more rare, but the regular exposure would be through these routes. Patients might be exposed through residuals also, and obviously inhalation, and of course any accidental spills. But always these chemicals need very cautious handling and storage. And in particularly in domestic environments, there are many reports of poisoning of children. And the majority of these exposures, the problems that they cause, end up in hypersensitivity reactions, contact dermatitis, in some cases asthma. And in fact, in one study from California, they've identified four types of microbicides as responsible for most occupational illnesses. These include, you know, the hyperchlorite, quats, chlorine gas, which would be much more confined to water treatment than in hospitals, and glutaraldehyde. And then, of course, nowadays, even though all of you know about glutaraldehyde and the problems that arise, there are a lot of replacement chemicals being used, and primarily these are OPA and oxidizers like hydrogen peroxide. So in that context, we know less about these chemicals, but undoubtedly we will recognize that they also present some hazards. And I think that's something that we need to be aware of for the future. Now, I mentioned earlier that microbicides produce many disinfectant byproducts, and that is primarily because they are such reactive chemicals. We also need to note that these byproducts can be more toxic than the original microbicide. This is certainly the case with hyperchlorite in drinking water, which is now obviously been very well studied, and in fact, some other chlorine chemistries are now understudied, but most other chemicals haven't been looked at in great detail in terms of the byproducts that they form. So it's a significant issue, and in fact, in drinking water, byproduct concentrations are regulated. And it's still something that is a big problem, if you like, for the drinking water industry, because they need to balance between the amount of disinfectant that's applied so that they can kill the pathogens in the drinking water and not putting so much that they exceed the regulated amounts of disinfectant byproducts that they are allowed in their water that they distribute to the consumer. So we certainly need a lot more work on disinfectant and microbicide byproducts and what problems that arise from them, whether it's in drinking water or just in general exposure to healthcare workers and patients. just mentioned briefly some of these chemicals that already cause problems. We know from chlorine-based products that are so broadly used, many of them are toxic. Some have been definitely identified as mutagens, and some of them quite strong mutagens. In fact, if they measure disinfectant byproducts, even in the breath of swimmers, they can detect these chemicals. So, and that just tells you that from a relatively brief contact that swimmers generally have with water in the swimming pools, that you are certainly absorbing these chemicals through the skin and by inhalation. Now, chlorine dioxide, which you don't really use in hospitals because it needs on-site generation, is a little different, although I don't think there we even understand how important or toxic the byproducts are. But here we're talking about oxidized byproducts, where, as for chlorine and chloramines, we're talking about byproducts which chiefly contain chlorine. So the effective microbicides, or most chlorine products, if they're used at the right concentration, are effective microbicides, but they're readily neutralized by soils, and so they need very careful use, both to control exposure and to ensure efficacy. Glutaraldehyde, I'm not going to dwell on greatly because you all know about its problems as a sensitizer and respiratory irritant, and sometimes asthma. And, of course, it in North America, it tends to have a relatively restricted use. And, in fact, in Europe, it's actually used also for environmental surface disinfection. So, potentially, you could have even more respiratory exposure there. Quaternary ammonium compounds are legendary in that they are probably the most widely used in North America. I know one survey we did many years ago found them to be in more than 75% of the products that were actually available as a registered products for purchase. However, that number may be even higher these days, I am not sure. Their primary level of activity is at the microbial membrane, where they tend to sort of poke holes in membranes and make them leaky. And they have somewhat lower human toxicity quite often, but they are still sensitizers, and you still find contact dermatitis and occupational asthma from these chemicals. Moreover, they're relatively refractory to environmental breakdown, although some bacteria can use them as a food source. But they are used in such large quantities that I think we will probably find problems of them turning up in drinking water, because so many consumer products also contain them. For example, your fabric softener contains quaternary ammonium compounds. Non-chlorine oxidizers, these are tending to take over in a lot of cases, hydrogen peroxide, peracetic acid, and outside healthcare, ozone is coming into its own also. Even for some sterilization processes, I know there's new ozone equipment in Canada. These chemicals are often thought to be much more benign because they don't leave these toxic chlorinated or phenol residues in the environment. But here the main problems may be from the oxidized byproducts and perhaps the microbial exposure, which I will talk about a little bit more in a minute. They are extremely hazardous at high concentrations, and especially if respired. So one needs to be extremely careful in handling high concentrations of them. This is not something that I want to say a lot about, but we do know that many of the toxic chemicals that are around today have not actually been tested for their toxicity properly. And what is used is these QSARs, which are sort of estimates of the toxicity based on the chemical structure of the chemical. And so this is widely used in human health and ecological risk assessments. And so when a new chemical is proposed, it goes through some of these evaluations to essentially guess at its toxicity. But it's based on some rationale, for sure. So we should look a little bit about what the targets are for these toxic chemicals. And unless you swallow the chemicals, it's very unlikely that you will actually see enough exposure to give you acute organ effects. So we're not primarily talking about real overt toxicity here. The effects are much more subtle and they show up in most sensitive systems at the cellular level. The immune system and defense mechanisms are some of the primary targets, and the genetic effects are also very important. So you have the potential for carcinogenesis, you have the potential for birth defects, and the targets are very similar in other species. So you can think about particularly the aquatic dwelling species that are exposed to everything that is discharged from hospitals and industries and homes. They are exposed. So this includes from bacteria to fish and even mammals in some cases. Now, this comes to what I think is one of the most important points to remember, is that although none of us really cares whether bacteria are exposed to toxins or not from the point of view of the health of the bacteria, what the toxins are actually doing is potentially changing those bacteria in much the same way as antibiotics change the bacteria. They can induce resistance. So ironically, bacteria are often used to assess how toxic the chemicals are. There are a lot of bacterial tests that are used to assess the mutagenicity of chemicals, but they're not used to assess the mutagenicity to bacteria. They're used to extrapolate from those tests to assess how mutagenic they might be in humans. But nobody really pays any attention to the effects that they might have on the bacteria themselves. And so I think that this is something that is critical to understanding this issue, because we already know the problems that we have with antibiotics, and they are, after all, just another toxin. So probably we need to think about this in very carefully. I mean, not that you can do personally anything about it in healthcare, but you need to understand some of the issues. And you have, of course, in any bacterium, you have a very high surface area to volume ratio. So you have very intimate contact and rapid reaction with these chemicals. So how do bacteria deal with toxins? And again, most of this knowledge comes from mechanisms of antibiotic resistance. But there are obviously a limited number of strategies that it's possible for a bacterium to use. And perhaps the one that would be, I think, quite prominent but is rarely demonstrated is exclusion. So the microorganism has a barrier around it which it is capable of modifying, and that can reduce the permeability to toxic chemicals or even synthesize other chemicals which can tie up the toxins outside of the cell. Now, the second strategy may work quite well, but it will not show up so much in the studies. The first strategy, unfortunately, if you think about a bacterium that has a reduced permeability, that's fine. It gets less toxin. But then, in fact, what happens is it also gets less food as well. And so it may not be able to grow as well, but it hangs around and grows very slowly until it can mutate and actually find some other way of dealing with the situation. The second option is for the bacteria to remove the toxin. And this is the one that is most notably associated with antibiotic resistance. And you have these increased pumps that cause efflux of the chemical from the cell. And so this can happen in a situation in the environment. A microorganism can either have its own pump to remove the chemical, or it becomes very closely associated perhaps with some other organism which has a very highly efficient pump. These pumps, whilst they often come about because of antibiotic resistance, they're not usually specific. So they can pump out, or they're sensitive to a lot of different chemicals. So that is perhaps the best known example. But then, of course, you have the other well-known example of detoxification. And we know that, again, for some antibiotics, there are mechanisms inside the bacterial cell which can detoxify the antibiotic through enzymes or other means. And similar things can happen for other chemicals. Now, the last option, altered targets, which is used in some cases by bacteria against antibiotics and probably against drugs and other natural environmental chemicals, is virtually impossible for them to use in the case of disinfectants and microbicides because there's so many targets that they cannot make all those alterations. So these are the basic mechanisms. So I wanted to look a little bit at the interactions that occur between humans, microbes, and chemicals. And so if we look at the dollar sign picture, that's meant to represent the humans, and here you have an interaction with the microorganisms, obviously through infection, but also humans are discharging large quantities of microorganisms into the environment because of their own activity in many different spheres. And if you look on the other side, you can certainly see effects of the chemicals on the cells of the human. And here these effects can be indirect, and they certainly can be modulated quite frequently through the immune system, through hormone receptors, etc. Chemicals also are discharged by human activity, not a big surprise. Now, the chemicals can affect the microorganisms. They can cause the microorganisms to grow because they act as nutrients, or they can mutate the microorganisms or even kill them in the case of microbicides. And, of course, the microorganisms themselves can change the chemicals. So you have this sort of really ternary interaction between three different moieties, which is rarely considered but is extremely important. And, of course, if you do get mutation of the microorganisms, you can get increased pathogenicity or increased survival. Now, when we're considering mutation, mutations can go both ways. They can also cause decreased pathogenicity and decreased survival. But, of course, these are not generally selected for in the same way. And particularly if you have a regular exposure, like in healthcare, to biocides, anything that's more sensitive to the biocide will just be wiped out. So in this chemical-microbe interface, our most concern is really for the toxins that are mutagenic to bacteria. Bacteria has a very plastic genome and readily adapts to many different situations. In fact, we know bacteria adapt to stress, but there is beginning to be some evidence now that one of the ways of adapting to stress when the stress becomes too great is actually to increase the mutation rate. In other words, I need to change if I can't actually deal with the situation. And what we have are some what are called mutator strains that actually have increased conjugation and gene exchange with other organisms. And these are often implicated in both pathogen evolution and in many infections. There's certainly one study that I know of which deals with looking at the E. coli that are found in urinary tract infections, and they actually found that many of these were mutator strains that had been isolated. What you have with your chemical exposure very often is that you're preconditioning your microbes to greater survival and potentially to increase capacity for resistance as well. And because of these common mechanisms of resistance, like pumps, perhaps less so for enzymes, but certainly the pumps and probably also the structural changes to the bacterial envelope, one is very likely to have some mechanisms of cross-resistance between toxins and antibiotics. Now, of course, there are many papers out there that are starting to deal with these issues, and some of these have, in fact, been sponsored by manufacturers of microbicides, and, of course, they claim there's very little evidence. And I think that we need to deal with this realistically because in the hospital environment, we have situations where microbicides are used and they maintain their concentration and they are very highly active. And it is not at that point that they are going to cause cross-resistance with antibiotics. It's once they become diluted and you have larger populations of microorganisms that are actually exposed at sublethal levels so that their ability to change is challenged, but they're not actually killed. I want to draw on some examples of these microbial adaptations. Now, most of these don't relate to microbicides, but perhaps a few of them do. We certainly have, in the case of microbicides, some evidence in the scientific literature that Clostridium difficile can actually form more spores in the presence of low levels of microbicides, and that potentially, of course, is of interest in healthcare. And there is some reports of cross-resistance between biocides and antibiotics. These have been reported with pine oils and triclosan in particular, and some other things. And we ourselves have done some work on chlorine in drinking water and have been able to demonstrate that certain highly multiply resistant E. coli can arise from one that had no resistance previously. However, for the most part, most of the really good evidence that exists in the literature for interactions between chemicals and microorganisms is really for metals. And I'm not going to go over these in great detail, but you can certainly look at the examples that are cited and show that there are many examples both on this slide and in the subsequent slide where it shows that we have problems with metals. In fact, looking at mine, I see I didn't include the subsequent slide because it is mostly environmental examples from the water environment. In particular, the best information is there for fish that have been exposed to metals. They become very sensitive to a lot of infections at that point. So we have these combined effects on the host, the living cells, trying to maintain a constant environment, which is this homeostasis, and we have toxins and pathogens all interacting at the same point at the cell. We have a host response that is affected by genetics, by age, you know, including hormones, immunity, and nutrition, of course, and the chemicals that modify the membranes might predispose to infections. And chemicals may also cause pre-existing infections to exacerbate or reactivate latent infections. And the inflammatory process obviously plays a big role as well, possibly including the endotoxins from the microorganisms. And infections can inhibit enzymes that break down toxins. So a lot of these effects can occur simultaneously, and simultaneously at the cell. And if you get an immune system effect, this can arise in many different forms because the immune system is such a super sensitive system to all kinds of external forces. Whether you can have any role in chronic and degenerative diseases is certainly something that does deserve some consideration. I won't dwell on these. Certainly air pollution is something that we need to think a lot about. And we've got a lot of issues here with wood smoke, tobacco smoke. There is some evidence of real problems. That is not largely a problem of hospitals, so I won't dwell on it, but it's certainly an issue. Food and water pollution. Certainly most of the chemicals that are in the air get scrubbed out by rain, and so they end up in our food and water, and you get simultaneous exposures to both microbes and many different chemicals. Looking at these combined effects, I think we have at least 7 instances where there are chemical combinations that interact with virus infections, and each, in fact, is a co-carcinogen. So there is certainly some evidence for real importance here. Although the chemicals that have been studied are not primarily microbicides, we have no reason to think that you could not have some similar effect. So just looking briefly at the microbial population changes, microbicides and antibiotics kill more than their targets. That's obvious. They kill all the susceptible bacteria that are carrying out useful and protective functions. So once the ecosystem is cleared of these, the resistant bacteria can actually multiply and dominate the environment due to the lack of competition. In fact, they can often use the bacteria that were killed as a food source. So So sometimes resistant bacteria are pathogens, and amongst these, of course, is mycobacteria. Legionella also can fit into this bin. And in general, microbial communities respond to antimicrobials by shifts from sensitive organisms to tolerant and resistant organisms. And so we have to bear in mind that this sublethal exposure can perhaps link to increasing antibiotic resistance in just the same way that antibiotic exposure can. This again is a summary slide. I think it summarizes the changes that you can see, and I think it just gives you some of the effects in summary here, so I won't go through them in detail. We have discussed them. So whether you're talking about humans or the environment, the dose, in fact, makes the poison. And many of these effects are very subtle, mediated through immune systems or defense mechanisms in the case of bacteria or lower animals. And overt toxicity is often relatively rare. The microbial advantage is really the ability to evolve very rapidly. As you may be aware, it's not that rare to actually have microbicides themselves that are colonized by bacteria. And the little snippet there illustrates that. If you look at the quotation at the bottom, it's really very unclear if bacteria read Nietzsche, or even if Nietzsche understood bacterial evolution. But certainly this old adage of what does not kill me makes me stronger applies very appropriately, I think. To sum up, in the last slide, we have simultaneous and sequential exposures to pathogens and chemicals. It's increasing, especially in healthcare settings. Toxicology of many chemicals and virulence factors are only partially understood and are not, at least in the case of the chemicals, not being widely studied. There are major gaps in our knowledge of the combined effects and the real-life exposures to chemicals and microbes, which we probably should think about filling in the coming years. And, of course, microbial control can create just as many problems as solutions. So microbicides are useful, but they are dangerous, and it's actually a double-edged sword that we need to use with a great deal of care. So prudence is definitely warranted, and strategies need to be put in place to avoid these sublethal exposures, which are potentially problematic. Are truly safe and effective biocides possible? I'm not even sure that I would hazard a guess as the answer to that question, but I think it's something that we should be actively discussing, and certainly we need multidisciplinary work and sustained funding in this area. So with that, I'll thank you for your attention, and I'll leave you with another quotation. And certainly whether or not William Osler is correct is a matter of debate, but if we assume he was, then I think undoubtedly probably the best disinfectant is common sense, even above and beyond soap and water. And so we need to think always about what we're doing. Don't toss it off as a very light issue. So from this, I don't think you should get the impression that I think microbicides should never be used. That's certainly not so. But if we need to cut antibiotic use to a minimum essential and continue to use microbicides and other chemicals as we do now, then I think I would predict you will continue to see an increase in antibiotic resistance. It would seem likely that resistant pathogens will increase, and the tendency then in healthcare would be to increase the use of microbicides to perpetuate this sort of vicious spiral. And the appearance of C. diff as a prominent nosocomial pathogen could just be the tip of the iceberg. So it sounds very dim prospects, but I think it's a topic which deserves an awful lot of discussion. It's starting to get more in Europe. It hasn't really hit the fan, as it were, in North America yet. So thank you very much for listening, and I hope this has triggered you to think some more about what you're doing day to day. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Susan, thank you very much. That was very interesting and enlightening. Are there countries that are using very little biocide in healthcare? I'm thinking of Holland and places like that.
In Holland, they don't use disinfectants in drinking water, except on very rare occasions. But normally, they don't use chlorine in drinking water. And I don't know that they have more infections that are drinking water related than we do. But I'm truly, I apologize, I just am not aware in Holland of what the general situation is. But certainly in Europe in general, the issue of toxic chemicals is becoming much more prominent. Many toxic chemicals either are already off the market or are going to be taken off the market. There is a biocides directive in Europe, and there's a lot of work going on in terms of discussions. I'm not sure how much science has been done yet, but there's a lot more awareness there than there is here. And in part, that may be because they have a much more intensely crowded populations and their cities. And so water that's used in one town is reused in the next town, you know, very quickly. So that may in part drive this, but I don't know how much of the discussion has moved into the healthcare side of things yet.
In your slides on the metals, one metal that I didn't see there, and forgive me if you mentioned it and I didn't catch it, was silver.
Silver certainly does have some toxic properties, but it is a lot less toxic than many of the other metals.
You see lots of things now that are being promoted with a silver coating.
Absolutely. And I personally don't advocate using this, but it's difficult to know. I'm not sure how effective it is. The other thing that you have to think about, now there may be some instances where a silver coating or a toxic coating might be very useful. And this is where each individual case needs to be discussed. I know in some cases the evidence for catheters, I think, is perhaps one of the better examples, although I haven't followed the literature in great detail. Because there you're talking about a limited use, you're talking about a high-risk situation, so there may be a net benefit. But, you know, many cases where you might be using silver, you could have it in place for a long time. You can get a biofilm buildup over the silver, so the silver loses its effectiveness, really, but you're still exposing your microbes. So I think each case has to be looked at on an individual basis, and it's not a formal risk assessment, but what you're really doing is the risk assessment informally to try and decide whether there is a net benefit to the use. And I mean, that I think could occur in many cases where you're using microbicides possibly unnecessarily right now.
You bring up one additional question that I have before I open the lines for questions, and that is biofilms. I don't know of any biocide that's required to be tested against a biofilm.
No, I mean, you're absolutely right. There is currently no required biofilm test that I'm aware of, certainly not in Canada. There may be in other places, but I can't speak for stuff that I don't know about. Again, you see, the issue is which biofilm would you use? One can have so many different biofilms in so many different situations. You could think about some kind of indwelling medical device, perhaps issues in joint surgery where maybe staph epidermidis might form a biofilm, but then you go to industry, you have a completely mixed biofilm of many different organisms. Already the regulators have problems keeping up. And so, I mean, I have to say that I think use of chemicals as a society is really a giant experiment on the human race, and not only the human race, but everything else that's out there.
I'll accept that as an answer for now, but I may challenge you on it again later.
I'm getting a lot of literature lately on the microfiber cloths.
Yeah, now, I haven't personally done much work on this, but I am aware of the fact that I think it probably does do, in many ways, a better job of cleaning than some other materials. One has to think about the issues of the charge on the cloth, because supposedly some of the cleaning properties rely on the fact that you have charges there, I think, electrical charges on the cloth fibers. And so I also believe that some of these can be neutralized. So, for example, if you were to use some of these cloths with some microbicides also, you may be sort of acting against each other. but I'm not 100% sure about this, so I would not want to give you an answer which might be incorrect. But this would be my guess is that you have to be quite careful how these cloths are used and how they're cleaned.
The idea, I think, for many of the manufacturers of these cloths is that they are to be used in lieu of disinfectants. They're to be used just with water.
Right, and that would make sense to me.
Yeah, I'm a little skeptical.
I'm getting presented with a variety of products when I do inspections of facilities such as daycares, and some of them are plant-based products that do actually have a Health Canada DIN number. How can I assess how effective these are? Can I rely on the fact that it's got a DIN number and therefore it will do what they claim it will do?
That's a very good question, but I'm not sure how you... I mean, the issue here is that the manufacturers of these products are required to present data, or if they don't present data, they have to... I'm not sure. If you're talking about a low-level microbicide that they are actually required to present the data, they might just be able to make a me-too claim, but I'm not sure, because plant products would not be a me-too kind of issue. Are you aware of what the plants are?
Thyme oil is one of them.
I believe it, that there is some data on it. It's not something that I have any personal experience with. I think that some of these issues, of course, and this isn't something I discussed today, but is very important, it's actually the quantity that you're able to deliver. Because in the literature on disinfection, it talks only about the concentration. But if you're wiping with a cloth, you can actually imagine that the amount of any product you're able to deliver, I don't think it matters whether it's, you know, a quat that has some commercial name. You're actually delivering such a tiny quantity, whether you're really having any real benefit other than perhaps spreading things around more dilutely, but certainly spreading them around. That's another issue which certainly deserves discussion, but it wasn't the topic today.
Thank you all for joining us. A special thanks to Virox Technologies again for providing sponsorship for this teleclass. Thank you to Randy and John and Nicole and everyone at Virox. Thank you to all of you, and a special thank you, of course, to Susan Springthorpe for preparing and delivering a wonderful teleclass presentation. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you, Paul.
And so until we speak again, everyone, goodbye.